Good morning. I build, for those of you who were not here yesterday, I build this as a Bible study for stubborn people. So I find myself wondering this morning if all of you are stubborn, or if you're just here to get some clues for how to live with all those other people back home. You know how that goes. I admitted to the, my name is Paul Rohde. I'm a pastor from New Ulm, Minnesota. It's been my privilege to facilitate the discussion this week. We're working in the book of Exodus. We've met the characters now, started with the Pharaoh and the midwives, and then Moses and Miriam and Aaron. Finally, yesterday, we met God in God's revelation to Moses. And today, we get to work on God's working on them, which happens in the plague. As horrible as the plagues are, I don't want us to miss the humor that happens in some of the especially the dialogue around it. It is, I think, hilarious on a level, and I hope we'll be able to sustain some of that. But just in case we can't, I put a quote on the board, a quotation for the day. Every mighty oak was once a nut that stood its ground. Okay? How's that for ammunition for stubborn people? But in the interest of the plagues, you need to push that one step back and say, but before a nut can stand its ground, it's got to let go of the tree it grew on. Got to be shaken loose or blown off or knocked loose. Something like that. I found that quote on a mug one of those weeks when I was feeling really pushed, and I was out for a walk to say, why am I so stubborn? Why don't I just let it go? And then I found the mug and bought it immediately to be a nut that would stand its ground. That's sort of on the levity side. On a much more serious side, before we even encounter the plagues, as the book of Exodus describes them for us, I would want to call all of us to humility, lest we ever interpret our own, perhaps, or especially somebody else's misfortune as a plague. It happens so glibly and so unmercifully that somebody is in the most painful of circumstances. Somebody else who is not in those circumstances says to them, well, obviously God wants you to let go of something. I think we never know enough to say that. I mean, it may be that in retrospect, we can look back in our own lives and see how those circumstances push us, stretch us, finally wrench us loose from whatever binds us. And that can be testimony to faith. But it simply diminishes too much what the book of Exodus, not to say the whole scriptures, has to say about suffering experiences when we reduce something that way and say, well, God, you know, God is doing this to you, so you'll let go. Well, let go of what? You know, we live not far from flood country. And I loathe to think of somebody going back and saying, well, God is teaching you to let go. You know, that's just too glib and too diminishing. Start with chapter 7, Exodus 7, verse 1. I'm going to read quite a chunk today before we get our discussion, because one of the things that's helpful to do is to hear some of the movement through the plagues before we discuss. So we'll read a little bit. And the Lord said to Moses, see, I make you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand upon Egypt and bring forth my hosts, my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch forth my hand upon Egypt and bring out the people of Israel among them. All the way through, we've tried to pay attention to the purpose clauses the times that the text says, for this reason, this will happen. And we've been watching this word know. The first chapter said, Pharaoh didn't know Joseph. The second chapter said, and God knew the oppression of the people. Now this chapter says, even the Egyptians shall know who I am and what I am about. We might wonder what kind of God the Egyptians come to know as these horrors are unleashed on them. Sometimes I think it's helpful to substitute another word for God when we're facing that sort of problem. A confirmant one time in Genesis, when in studying Genesis 3, said to me, why would Adam and Eve hide? You can take this chair. The left hand of the Father.
Stay with the baby.
I'm glad. Said, why would anybody hide from God? That makes no sense to me. God is love. God loves you. Why would you hide from God? I said, well, substitute the word truth for God. We say God is truth. And now you hear the Bible say, okay, stand up. The truth about you is going to come. In front of all these people, would any of you feel an impulse to hide? Joe Sittler one time was reacting to the prayer of confession, to whom all hearts are open, all known, and from whom no secrets are hid. And he said, if that were said of anybody but God, I would lose my job, I would lose my marriage, I would certainly lose my reputation. Okay? So substitute truth. What kind of God are the Egyptians going to come to know? Maybe it's helpful to substitute the word justice. What is it going to take to know justice? That's a question for our world. We'll get to that in our discussion. That is the Lord that God wants them to know. They shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch forth my hand upon Egypt and bring out the people of Israel from among them. And Moses and Aaron did so. They did as the Lord commanded them. Now Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 years old, when they spoke to the prophet. We'll skip the signs of the rod and go right to the plague, number 1, verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water. Wait for him by the river's brink, and take in your hand the rod which was turned into a serpent. And you shall say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. And behold, you have not yet obeyed. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Here it comes again. You're going to know I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile with the rod that is in my hand, and it shall be turned to blood. And the fish in the Nile shall die, and the Nile shall become foul, and the Egyptians will loathe to drink water from the Nile. The Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your rod and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the rivers, their canals, and their ponds, and all their pools of water. Hear the repetition, the intensification, all the water, that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. He lifted up the rod and struck the water that was in the Nile, and all the water that was in the Nile turned to blood. And the fish in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. And there was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same by their secret arts. So Pharaoh's heart remained hardened, and he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Pharaoh turned and went into his house, and he did not lay even this to heart. And all the Egyptians dug round about the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. The magicians both mystify and humor me. I mean, they mystify me because this doesn't make logical sense. If all the water in the country is already blood, then where is the water by which they make more blood? But it humors me, because it seems to me that if you were suffering under some terrible plague, some horrible power greater than you, and wanted to demonstrate that your magicians were just as powerful, you would undo the plague instead of making the plague worse. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just a suggestion, change the blood back to water. You know? Pharaoh, did you think of that? Or have your magician, isn't that funny? That you've got this horrible plague. This is the plague for the boys in confirmation just gone nuts. You know, they imagine the locker room after gym, the drinking fountain at school, and wouldn't it be something? But lest we not practice gender equality, the next plague is when the girls catch up. Here we go. 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. Then the Lord said to Moses, go into Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go. The refrain echoes through each of them, that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will plague all your country with frogs. The Nile shall swarm with frogs, which shall come up into your house, and into your bedchamber, and on your bed, and into the houses of your servants and of your people. We talked about the Bible's preoccupation with specificity the other day. And into your ovens and your kneading bowls, frogs in the holden kitchen. The frogs shall come up on you and on your people and on all your servants. And the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your rod over the rivers, over the canals, and over the pools, and cause frogs to come upon the land of Egypt. Can't you just see junior high girls? So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. But the magicians did the same by their secret arts. Great! More frogs! And brought frogs upon the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh called Moses and Aaron and said, entreat the Lord to take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. Just a chink in the mortar of the Pharaoh's heart, huh? Just a chink. If this plague can end, then I will let the people go. It's a foxhole prayer. Get me through this, God, and then I will. I have a joke I love to tell, a little reluctant. I told it the last time I did the Bible study at Holden, but I suppose it can be in the tape library in two places. There is a man who was sick unto death and terrified. So he called his pastor for a call. The pastor came to call, and the man said, Pastor, I am so sick, and I'm afraid I'm going to die. Will you pray for me? The pastor said, of course, I'll pray for you. He said, I want you to know that if you pray for me, and if I recover, I will give $10,000 to the church. Well, I'm here to tell you the pastor prayed. No pastor is above it. And the man recovered. But there was no sign, of course, of the check. And a week went by, and another week, and a month. And the pastor took a workshop on assertiveness. And decided he was going to deal with this. And so he went out to see the guy, and he said, you know, how are you doing? He said, I'm doing well. He said, do you remember how sick you were? Oh, do I ever. And the pastor said, and do you remember that I prayed for you? He said, yes, I remember, and I want you to know I'm grateful. And he said, and do you remember that you said that if I prayed for you and you recovered, you would give $10,000 to the church? Pastor, he said, I think that just goes to show you how sick I really was. So the Pharaoh says, and you know, sometimes we raise the question, who are we? How easily we congratulate ourselves for these prayers that say, if it's over, then then I'll be just, then I'll be merciful. Would that our hardness of heart were resolved so easily. Moses said to Pharaoh, be pleased to command me when I am to entreat. Be pleased to command me. Tell me when it is that we're to leave, for you and for your servants and for your people, that the frogs be destroyed from you and your houses and be left only in the Nile. And he said, tomorrow. Well, that's the check is in the mail line, if I've ever heard one. Tomorrow, I'll let you go, right? Tomorrow, I'll quit. Tomorrow, I'll change. Tomorrow, I'll go for a jog. Moses said, be it as you say, that you may know, that here it comes again, that there is no one like the Lord your God. The frogs shall depart from you and your houses, and your servants, and your people. They shall be left only in the Nile. So Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs as he had agreed with Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses. The frogs died out of the houses and courtyards and out of the fields. And they gathered them together in heaps, and the land stank. But when Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hardened his heart and would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the earth, that it may become gnats throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so. Aaron stretched out his hand with his rod and struck the dust of the earth. And there came gnats on people and beast. All the dust of the earth became gnats throughout all the land of Egypt. The magicians tried by their secret arts to bring forth gnats, but they could not. So there were gnats on human and beast. And the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. Movement of recognition, not yet knowing the heart of God, but the finger of God, okay? But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. There are commentators who group the plagues. And I don't know which you find easiest to read. Maybe you can't read either one. I had a few sheets left over from when they did this in my parish. If you'd like one, you can take one after class. They group the plagues by the place they happen. The first one happened at the river. Second one happened at the Pharaoh's throne. Third one happened from a distance. No direct encounter at all. And then it goes again. The flies will happen at the river. I've got darkness. Livestock. From the throne, the livestock are killed and then boil. Hail and locusts and darkness. If you read it through, you can see a movement of intensification and a movement in the kind of bartering and bantering that happens between the Pharaoh and Moses. Now, what I want to make clear that the severity is not in terms of the event. The severity is in terms of the way people react to it. I mean, already at the frogs, Pharaoh is saying, okay, make it end and I'll let them go. And then we get a little ways further and the Pharaoh will say, okay, you can go, only don't go so far. Okay, don't go a 3 days journey, just go into the land. And then a little farther, the Pharaoh will say, well, we'll just let the men go. And you see, so the Pharaoh keeps making these movements and then retreating into what the text always describes as hardness of heart. So that movement happens and it intensifies. I mean, we also see the intensification because after the frogs, the magicians are no longer able to replicate it. So that, we're talking about power. Who's got power? First two weren't that impressive. We can do that. Say the Egyptians. But as of the gnats or the mosquitoes, then the magicians can't replicate it. That also gets more intense because with the second set, they no longer happen throughout the land. They only happen to the Egyptians and not to the Israelites. So that distinction gets made. The flies, and it's the livestock of the Egyptians that die. And the Israelites are spared. So, you know, you can feel how that tightens. And this just keeps building and building until there is darkness, darkness in all of Egypt, at which point Yahweh, I am, the God of Israel, is taking on not merely Pharaoh, but the Egyptian pantheon, the gods of Egypt, because the head of the gods of Egypt is the God of light. So what happens when the Israel God brings darkness over the whole land? Where is your God, Pharaoh? Where is Ra, the God of light? What is this God about? You hear how that each of these ups the ante? Those things by way of description. I suppose the most important thing to talk about is hardness of heart. What do you hear it saying? What is it? Where does it come from? And what does it take to change it? Just for our relationship, I bragged at 7:45 about your discussion yesterday, as much as I bragged to you about their discussion, okay? Into treating my kids alike, so that life is fair. I thought our discussion ended in a real helpful place yesterday for how hard it is for us to change. And I don't remember the person who made the comparison for us between oppression and addiction, but I think that's real helpful for us to have another frame of reference for what does it take for change to happen? What kind of change is being sought? One of the reasons I didn't want to discuss this too soon, I wanted to get a number of these refrains before us. So we heard the text say, God said, I will harden the Pharaoh's heart. And then we heard the text say, the Pharaoh hardened his heart. Then we heard the text say, the Pharaoh's heart was hardened, the passive voice. I've come to appreciate that ambiguity may be really helpful. Where does hardness of heart come from? Sometimes we are the agency of that hardness. I am stubborn, I'm not going to do it, and you're not going to make me. My heart is hard, unchanging, unbending. There are other times I really want to change. I want to be more merciful. I want to be more just. I want to be more accepting. Okay? And it doesn't come. The same thing happens out there, and I'm just as torqued as the last time. It's like, where does this hardness come from? And what do we make of it coming from God? God's willingness to say, I will harden that they may know. What do you hear, honey? What do you wonder about? What do you want to discuss? Go ahead.
Well, I was raised in Kansas.
Well, that explains everything.
And that's awful close to Missouri. Missouri mules have this particular problem. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So I have a theology of the Missouri mule where if we don't sit eye to eye with God, he'll tap us on the shoulder. And if we just still don't catch it, then he's going to poke us in the back. And if we still don't see, he's going to push us a little bit. If we still don't see it, he's probably going to knock us down on our fanny. And about that time, we get either catching the message so we know what God wants us to know, or we turn out so stubborn we've got that hardness of heart that you're talking about.
Okay. A theology of mules.
So it's the attitude that we bring to it, and God just simply says, okay, so be it.
My concern with hardness of heart is, who in the world can resist God? And if God's will is that our heart be hardened, wow.
Yeah.
To me, that's scary. But then again, the flip side is we're also talking about the same God who can soften hearts.
That is the flip side.
To me, just to finish off, and the other piece that I would say to that is we were talking about transgressing against the Holy Spirit. I think this is where we're at.
Yeah.
Where we just simply won't budge. We don't want to see it any other way than our own way and not God's way. Mm-hmm. And God can't change what we don't want changed in us.
I'd like to just separate your questions. You started saying, who can resist God? Who doesn't resist God? And what does it take to stop the resistance of God? What does it take to stop the resistance of God except to be given one's own resistance? Okay? So then have your resistance. Other comments? I'm sure there are other comments. Go ahead.
Well, I don't see Pharaoh as someone who was not involved in this process, because God has given all of us a free choice, a free will to, as you mentioned earlier in the session, to be humble towards him. And I'm sure in Pharaoh's culture, he was kind of the God. And so for him to let go of control was, he chose not to, repeatedly it seems, until the tension was such that God said, okay, you know, this is the varnish is hard now. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I saw it sort of a process. There were some opportunities given, and he repeatedly chose not to.
I feel he was used for a purpose. He was needed. The Hebrews, of course, by their own fault, had a long time to go ahead. And they perhaps needed all these signs of his power to get them through what they had to go through before they came. Pharaoh was needed, and that's why his heart was hardened. He was a tool in God's plan.
It takes me back to what you said on the first day about the power. Are we willing to give up what we see, what we perceive as our own power? Or are we willing to fear, do we want to soften our hearts to fear God? Do we keep the power? Do we let God have the power?
Yeah, I think there is something there about what God is doing, or what the text is demonstrating again and again that God's doing. Not all of you have been able to be here for all the sessions. I also said at the beginning, I think, in one of the two, that when we did this back home in the parish, I didn't expect to read all the plagues. I thought we would read a few of the plagues, like we end up doing when you're trying to do it in 5 1-hour sessions, and then talk about them and sort of summarize them. But when we did it at home, each of the groups read all the plagues. I hope all of you have a chance sometime to read them all out loud. It's amazing how powerful is the repetition, the redundancy. Let my people go. Yeah, we've heard that. Pharaoh's heart was hardened and he would not let, especially in an instant gratification, sitcom kind of culture where everything gets resolved in 30 minutes. You can't read all 10 plagues in 30 minutes. And they're still not resolved. And it just keeps going and going so that you not only hear, but you feel the frustration of this and the depth of it. Because the reason I appreciate the connection with addiction is it's amazing how many times when you're dealing with something like addiction, or last evening in the homily, the illustration was mental illness, that the response becomes a kind of rearrangement of the circumstances that doesn't get at the root of it. What is being feared? or what is the source of power? Doesn't get at that at all. So Pharaoh, I mean, Pharaoh is willing to do that. One of my favorite quips is rearranging chairs on the Titanic. You know, committees love to do that. Rearrange chairs on the Titanic without paying attention to this hole in the hull. And the text wants us to get at the absence of that fear, or the resistance to the fear, awe, radicality of trusting that power. So these texts are going to push us. The plagues push the Pharaoh, and as we read them, it pushes us to this kind of radicality of letting go. It isn't a matter of growing on a different branch. When a nut lets go of the branch, it's falling, and it doesn't know where it's going to land. The first step of any 12-step program is life is out of control, but God will help. And you see, it didn't say anything about the circumstances or the sources of the circumstances. And you know, people in all kinds of oppressive, compulsive circumstances hear in it the thrust of what needs to happen.
Somehow or other, this is reminding me of that little incident in one of C.S. Lewis' stories about the man who had the monster attached to him. He hates this monster, but he does not really want to let it be torn from him. And when it is, he screams.
Yeah. I thought of the exact same episode. It's in the Great Divorce. C.S. Lewis, The Great Divorce. A bus ride from hell to heaven. Okay? In C.S. Lewis' marvelous imaginative science fiction. I will only tell you that a goodly portion of the folks who go decide not to stay. Amazing. And I had thought of that exact same episode. The lust. Yeah. No, that's all right. We're still reading C.S. Lewis. Jeff?
I was going to suggest taking a look at this from Pharaoh's standpoint, too. I mean, if he lets the Israelites go, put yourself in his shoes. And this is the livelihood of his country. Now, we might look at him as being selfish and hard of heart personally, but he's also, certainly at some level, trying to protect the integrity of his country. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't know God? They don't know Yahweh. They know their polytheistic society that they have set up. Not to make an excuse for Pharaoh, but yet he's not coming at this from the same point of view that the Israelites are coming. He's got a lot to lose by letting these people go, like maybe his life, which everyone clings to. I'm not trying to play Pharaoh advocate here, but yeah. I think
he's just mad because he beat him in Skipola.
No time for redemption.
I'm glad you paint the description, because at the root of this is economic injustice. It's a system of economics built on slavery that's not going to work without slaves. Anybody read 19th century American history in the South? It won't work without slaves. And if you change it, see, if you change it, it's just like an explosion. It's not a rearrangement. It's cathartic.
Well, there's no evidence of blue-collar Egyptians anywhere.
No.
In this. And no society could operate without that level of employment, as it were, within the country, that level of service. Mm-hmm. So I suggest he's got a lot to lose by just saying, okay, we got a few bugs around here, go ahead, you guys can take off.
He'd be unelected, you think, Jeff?
Pardon?
He'd be unelected.
As I was reading this, it goes back all the way to chapter 4, before Moses even left to go to Egypt. God said, you know, you're going to go and do all this, but I'm going to harden his heart. And so I took this as a word of good news to Moses, saying, you're not responsible for his actions. I'll take care of him. And you're not responsible for being successful. And so the first plague doesn't work, don't worry about it. The second plague doesn't work, don't worry about it. You just do what I tell you to do, and don't, you're not responsible for his actions. Keep going. Keep doing what I'm telling you to do. So I took it more as a word of good news to the ones who were doing God's work.
It's certainly a word of freedom, isn't it? This is God's story. I mean, when I heard your mule theology, my only experience with mules was a very weak moment when our Kiwanis Club was sponsoring one of those god-awful mule softball games. And in a weak moment, I signed up. And so, I mean, it's still mules and all the things you described that mules are capable of doing, but there's this guy behind the pitcher with a high-pitched whistle that none of us can hear, but the mules can hear it. And these mules are trained absolutely to do whatever the whistle guy does, and you are totally out of control in front of all the rest of your Kiwanis Club and your kids and the whole town, and the whistle blows and the mule just runs, you know, and you try to turn that mule around, there's no turning that mule around. You know, it's a marvelous analogy. Some of you who are sewing need to be careful. It looks like you're raising your hand.
I guess when I identify with the mule theology, I would put myself in Pharaoh's shoes. I suspect Pharaoh, somewhere deep in his heart, wants to do right, somewhere. But it takes a lot of lessons. We are stubborn. I know I am. And so maybe God hardens Pharaoh's heart in order that Pharaoh might learn the lesson well.
The Pharaoh has a lot to lose, Jeff says, by heeding the voice of God. But what do we know about the story and how much Pharaoh has to lose by not heeding the voice of God? I mean, there is the risk of change, the risk of justice, which I'm convinced in our culture is as radical and as risky as it was in the 19th century when slavery was being argued. To try to talk about a culture that will be just, an economy that would not exploit the poor, I think it's just as radical. I heard a black preacher in Chicago in April say, racism in our culture is child's play compared to classism. What we have to lose by letting it go. But the flip side of that is what we have to lose by not letting it go. See, the thing is, the Israelites aren't free, but the Pharaoh isn't free either. The Pharaoh is more bound, trapped, caught, protecting this system, sustaining it. There was another commenter.
Yeah, but you get it.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
We're almost every day in this same situation. We're both the Pharaoh and we're both Moses, because there's things that we don't want to let go, and there's things that are being demanded that we do let go. So it's kind of a trap both ways, like you were saying. You're caught up of, I want to let go of hating somebody or disliking the situation or fighting for justice. And on the other side, you have, everybody has these even right now in their life. You're both people.
I really appreciate this discussion because I haven't heard anybody yet say, I don't like this text. Couldn't we read the Psalms? I like the Psalms. That's right, there are some Psalms we don't like too. That more important than whether we like the text is whether or not the text is true. And I just hear us affirming levels of the truth of the text and our need for the text, not unlike an addict needs the truth of the consequences of the addiction, the pain, the agony, the risk of not relinquishing being freed in order that he or she may be freed. Go ahead.
I think we also should look at the point of view of the Egyptians.
Yeah.
Because if the Pharaoh had let them go after blood and frogs and their whole economic system was ruined, they would blame him. Or it's all his fault to let them go. But by continual plagues, they probably thought after 10, 12 of them, well, no wonder. I mean, he had to let them go because they were harassing us so in this way. Either I'm so in a democratic system where I want to feel a part of it. Perhaps the Egyptians were under such anarchy that they went along with whatever the Pharaoh said. But I think, too, it probably helped to pull them with the continuation of plagues to kind of see how the Pharaoh had to finally let them go.
Yeah. It, on an intellectual level, maybe helped them. But on another level, it's important to bring to our attention how often it happens in systemic sort of change that innocent people suffer in the transition. Go ahead.
I was going to say there's a whole other dynamic that relates to this too, where Pharaoh was a victim of his own history. In the very beginning, when we studied about how he came to the point of fear of all of these people rising up, and therefore he had to suppress them into slavery, maybe we're a little bit where we're victims of our own history too. We have come to the point where we have done well on the backs of others. And there's fear underlying much of what there might be to let go. And so that makes it harder for us to let go and to do what we need to do to be a different people.
Mm-hmm. Just to put in even a different bent on it, not only was the Pharaoh looking at the destruction of his economic system and social system, but he was also looking at the destruction of his entire belief system, his entire culture system that was based on, in that time, my God is stronger than your God. And at any time, if he had capitulated at any time before the darkness, he basically would say, yeah, your God is stronger than mine. Well, he eventually did that anyway. But God had to destroy or overcome their head God in order for them to totally understand the fullness of the power of God, but at the same time totally destroyed their whole belief system and their whole culture system. The whole very purpose of their existence was destroyed in all of that, as well as their economic situation.
See, death and resurrection go together, don't they? Resurrection, newness of life, means death of the old life. I love the natural world kinds of images of that. A cocoon and a butterfly, that sort of metamorphosis. You can be a butterfly, but the cocoon has got to go. It's got to be shattered. Forest fires, a dramatic example of that. The jack pines, the seeds that will not germinate except under intense heat, that what looks like is destroying the forest is in fact renewing the forest. Labor, I think, of life, but the pregnancy dies, and its pain is killing. I have witnessed it myself, that intense, horrendous kind of narrow edge, all the other details. There's no rearranging chairs then. You know, it's all focused on the next breath to get through this, you know, that, and that is where trust is. Trust is not about keeping the props to make a gradual kind of transformation possible. Metamorphosis is about letting go of the props. There might be new. And that is what baptism is. You know, all of these things. The Red Sea is the baptismal comparison. Go ahead.
Going back to the chapter 4 where you get the impression that God had this all mapped out. I'm going to harden his heart. I'm going to do these. You know, he knew how many plagues he would have to do before he was going to win. So it makes me question of who is he playing to here? Is this, I mean, he could have won in the first battle if he chose to, but instead he chose to take this long series. So, you know, is he really playing to the Israelites or is he playing to the Egyptians? And it seems to me he's playing to the Israelites in the sense that they're the ones who have the story now to go back to and to see that their God won. The Egyptians didn't follow the Israelites and become part of them.
He is not playing to efficiency. Of that we can be sure. We can all think of more efficient ways to do it. I appreciate that comment. I want to read another couple of passages and then say some things about the way the Israelites used the story. Okay? Let's turn to chapter 11. The preface to the 10th plague. The Lord said to Moses, "Yet one plague more I will bring upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards he will let you go hence. When he lets you go, he will drive you away completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people, that they ask every one of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor jewelry of silver and of gold." And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. And Moses said, "Thus says the Lord, about midnight I will go forth in the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits upon his throne, even to the firstborn of the maidservant who is behind the mill, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there has never been, nor ever shall be again. But against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, not a dog shall growl, that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between the Egyptians and Israel. And all these your servants shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, Get you out, and all the people who follow you. And after that I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you, that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people of Israel go out of the land. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, they shall take every man a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for a lamb, then a man and his neighbor shall... Oh, I lost my place.
Verse 4.
4, thank you. Then a man and his neighbor next to his house shall take according to the number of persons. According to what each can eat, you shall make your count for the lamb. The lamb shall be without blemish, a male a year old. You shall take it from the sheep or from the goat, and you shall keep it until the 14th day of this month, when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill their lambs in the evening. Then they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the house in which they eat them. They shall eat the flesh that night roasted with unleavened bread and bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled with water, but roast it, its head with its legs and its inner parts. And you shall not let none of it remain until the morning. Anything that remains until the morning, you shall burn. And so on. Okay, verse 12. It is the Lord's Passover, verse 11. For I will pass through the land of Egypt this night, and I will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both human and beast. And on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you upon the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague shall fall upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. This text it seems to me very clearly is functioning on two levels. On one level, it's descriptive of the 10th plague and what's going to happen, right? They're going to kill a lamb and spread the blood and the doorposts. The angel of death will pass over and the firstborns of Egypt will die. On another level, it's already prescriptive of the ritual that will sustain Israel for the rest of time, the Passover. And I find it very persuasive. I've admitted to some of the folks who've been around this week that more and more I'm convinced the book of Exodus is about memory. That even before the event happens, the text is concerned that it's going to be remembered. Isn't that interesting? That even before it happens, I mean, it's like buying film before you go on a trip, you know? To make sure that you've got some way to remember it, some systems of action. In the Old Testament, the word remember is much stronger than simply recall or bring to mind. It's more like reenact or live it out again. And when you do the Passover, how many of you have been able to participate in a Seder supper? Quite a few of you. The whole rite is written so that you become the children of Israel and you are bound and the oppressions of the world are recalled. And as we remember who God is in the way God revealed God's self, we become those people who are spared the plague and brought through the Red Sea. Okay? We become them. We enact them. Now, a couple of you, spoken on behalf of the Egyptians, have the Seders that you've participated in included the acknowledgement of the Egyptian suffering? It's a marvelous part of the rite where people are reminded that a cup of wine is a symbol of joy and a full cup is a symbol of complete joy. And if the cup is spilled, joy is diminished. So when the plagues are recalled in the Passover rite, the wine is spilled. The head of the household takes a drop and spills it for each of the plagues, because the rite says, we do not rejoice that others had to suffer for our freedom. Our joy is diminished because the Egyptians suffered that we might be made free. Marvelous gift of remembrance, not only for Israel and what God gave Israel that fateful night, but of Egypt and what Egypt endured in the sake of justice. Freedom for oppressed and oppressor. Comments? Questions? Go ahead.
First, I just, as we read through, I just caught me in, I just kind of, what's that about? Verse 8, the end of verse 8. Then Moses, hot with anger, left Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. He had told Pharaoh what was going to happen. And he's really angry and he leaves. No explanation of his anger. It just goes on. Do you have any thoughts?
I'll open that up. Any thoughts about the kind of anger Moses felt?
I have one, please.
Go ahead.
I have experienced sometimes in my life so much anger that I was afraid of losing control, and so I had to walk away rather than to engage. And that particularly happened to me in a rather foreign situation for the early period of time I was in the Navy. And I just had to learn the military way. And the one time I didn't do it, I regretted that, but it took six guys to pin me down. But so I think that's the kind of thing that could happen to Moses.
Could be. The role of anger in the Bible is fascinating. I cherish it because I think it's so real and so true. If God is a God of justice, if God hears and remembers and sees and knows the suffering of people, I think God has got to be angry. God's in, or Moses, you know, the instruments of God, them. In some ways, the indifference is so much scarier to me. Go ahead.
Well, Moses had a particular problem that he was raised almost like an Egyptian, being part of the Pharaoh's family. So you've got to feel an anger or sorrow against what's going to happen to these people, that the Pharaoh's not listening, that it has to go that far. And you just aren't, it's like you're all mixed up with anger. You're sorrowful that it's going to happen. You know it's going to happen. You can't stop it. You just, like a confused anger. And if you can't explain it, you just, okay, and walk away. You've reached the point where you can't do anything because you have love for what's going to happen to the people, and yet there's no way you can stop it.
It may be a real insight into the nature of anger, what you just said. That one of the reasons it's so powerful is because it's such a mix of emotions. This discussion has done well on the kind of cosmic level, you know, the systems of injustice and the way they perpetuate themselves, all that kind of thing. I shared in the 745 group my own confusion or mystification at the presence of refusal to change. I mean, sometimes when people who are stuck come to talk, you know, they feel stuck, need change, want change. One of my responses to them is to say, well, what options do you see? And many times they can't see options. That's why there is the need to talk, you know, the absence of options. So then I try to just brainstorm. You know, well, maybe you need to, or have you thought about, or could you try? And I am amazed how many times people respond by saying, oh, well, I couldn't do that. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you wanted to change. I thought you wanted change. I think about an instance where a person was just mortified by economic circumstances changing. I said, well, maybe you'll need to look at different housing. Oh, we can't do that. This house has Central Bank. You know, we had been talking about life and peace and, you know, the need for some kind of sense of serenity. Sold out for Central Bank, you know. I don't mean to be ridiculous. I mean, I think so many times the systems that are our bodies or our lives are so like the systems that are our culture. You know, the more we can build bridges between them and see how hard it is for us to take this one little step and then appreciate how hard it is for the whole to move, to be shaken loose. And then there are those instances where people insist on destroying themselves.